Welcome to the Myasthenia Gravis edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the MG community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is your host, Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor, reporting from the 15th International Conference on Myasthenia and Related Disorders here in the Netherlands. Our guest is Dr. Angela Vincent of the University of Oxford in England. Dr. Vincent has just received a Lifetime Achievement Award, the first ever in the history of the Myasthenia Gravis Foundation of America, which has organized this conference. Congratulations, and thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you.
So, tell us about yourself and about the award.
Well, I'm now retired. In the UK, you have to be retired at some stage. Medically trained, because I did do medicine. I spent a year looking after patients. I rather enjoyed it, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. I tried to become a scientist. I did a master's in biochemistry at University College in London, which is where we were living at the time. Then went into basic research, but my basic research ended up being on acetylcholine receptors and the neuromuscular junction. And as we now know very well, that is where the disease myasthenia gravis occurs. And in fact, at this meeting, it has become as clear as never before, perhaps, that the neuromuscular junction and myasthenia gravis is an immensely important disease. It's relatively common, so not actually so rare, and I could mention something about that later. But more than ever, it's become the topic for people, the go-to disease for people who want to run trials that might be effective in autoimmune conditions, particularly those which are caused by specific autoantibodies like myasthenia.
Very interesting. So let's back up if we can and tell us about yourself and how you got into medicine. And I should also say that in the introduction, Dr. Kevin O'Connor said that you became a well-respected scientist at a time when there were very few women in STEM. This is an interesting point. Can you tell us a little bit about your life?
Okay. I did medicine first. That was principally because my mother didn't think being a scientist was very respectable. Female doctors, that was quite acceptable. So I did medicine because that was what my parents were keen on, particularly my mother. I found that although I enjoyed the practical side, I delivered babies in my training. I did some appendectomies when I was doing surgical work. So I was quite into it, but I didn't find that there was enough interest in what was the underlying cause of the diseases that we were trying to treat. And I found that very frustrating. And that's why I left clinical medicine over 50 years ago and did a master's in biochemistry in order to go into pure research.
You're from London originally?
Wimbledon.
Wimbledon. What made you decide to switch to research and specifically to myasthenia gravis research?
Well, as I say, I was doing basic research, and at first my project was not very successful, but that didn't matter. It was a rather silly project somebody's funded me to do. But then I went upstairs and went to the department above, which was an absolutely world-famous department working on neuromuscular junction and acetylcholine receptors, among other things. And I was just incredibly lucky to work for 5 years with somebody called Ricardo Miladi, who latterly was in University of Irvine in California for most of the end of his long career. And but at the time he was in London, and I worked with him for 5 years and learned a great deal about doing science in the lab. And the way he did things was very, very special. And he actually was the person who linked up with the neurologist, because he was interested in looking at myasthenia, because we were measuring acetylcholine receptors in muscle from rats and mice and all sorts of species. And he wanted to do human work.
Very interesting.
Because he knew about myasthenia. I'd forgotten. I don't remember learning about it in my medical career, but he remembered.
What's the prevalence of MG?
It's a bit difficult to say, because MG, like so many things, isn't a single disease.
Right.
There are early onset patients who are the ones that used to be recognized almost selectively, which meant people, and they're not that common. But over the years, and particularly as the population has aged, and as the diagnosis of myasthenia has improved, largely but not entirely due to the fact that we have antibodies you can measure, it's become obvious, or absolutely obvious, in every centre that works on the disease, that there is a much larger number of elderly patients. People over the age of 60 are now getting myasthenia for the first time, and they're called late onset myasthenia, and they are, in some studies, five times as many of those as there are of the young patients, who were typically the young females.
Why are people over 60 suddenly getting myasthenia gravis?
Well, it's a very good question, and it's one of the things I think we should be addressing more at this meeting. And in fact, if I'd had more time and to think about how to answer and to thank everybody for my award, it was one of the things I thought, that's something you haven't really concentrated on yet.
No, in fact, from what I've talked to, the preponderance of patients are teenage girls, but we don't hear too much about pediatric cases or people over 60.
Well, I'm surprised, because everybody's aware of them, but I think that they have been somewhat neglected, considering how over about 25 years now we've been aware of that older age group. And it seems to be getting larger and larger, perhaps because of the population increasing. Because in Oxford, for instance, the diagnostic tests that I used to do for the acetylcholine receptor antibodies, we were finding them in patients of 100 for the
really?
First time. Yes.
Really?
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Could it be environmental factors?
Well, there are all sorts of possibilities. I had a little project with my daughter, actually, who was a doctor, and still is a doctor, and she was doing a stroke project in London as part of her very early training, working on a stroke team. And we thought that perhaps people on statins, which were increasingly used in the elderly to prevent strokes and to prevent heart attacks, that the statins might be inducing myasthenia.
Oh, great, I'm on statins.
Yeah, well, so am I. Everybody's on statins. The answer was we couldn't find any evidence of that, or of people undergoing heart surgery having then a reaction against the acetylcholine receptors subsequent to heart surgery, which is obviously another common thing that happens. And in those days, it used to be open heart surgery. Of course, now it very often isn't so. But the incidence isn't going down, as far as I know. So far, nobody's actually identified anything. But it is important, because those are the patients who have complicated comorbidities, other diseases. And so the diagnosis can be delayed, because people say, oh, well, they probably had a minor stroke, or, you know, they're weak because they're getting older. Because people still have that concept that you should be weaker when you get older. And actually, from my own experience, it's quite true.
You mentioned also about antibodies. What about the absence of a therapeutic biomarker for myasthenia gravis?
A therapeutic biomarker? You mean something you can use for everybody? I agree. It would be very nice if there was some other way of measuring dysfunction of the neuromuscular junction that was caused by the immune system, other than the antibodies. I mean, we know the antibodies are pretty good for probably up to about 90% of patients, but there are always some who are negative. And this so-called seronegative myasthenia is still a problem. And that's one of the things that people keep asking me. They say, well, you know, you've helped to reduce the number of patients who are negative. Why are there still so many? And that's an interesting question. And it's probably one that applies to other rare diseases. The fact is that myasthenia is now recognized much more frequently. It's understood much more frequently. People are wanting to diagnose it, so they send more samples for testing, and they're disappointed when those samples are negative.
As I understand, you're one of the early identifiers of seronegative MG.
Yes, oh, definitely. Yes,
right.
Now that's something I think I can...
Something you're quite proud of.
Well, yes, because it was me that, even within our group, I pointed out that this was a collection of patients who didn't seem to quite fit the same distribution as the ones who had acetylcholine receptor antibodies, partly age, but partly that their clinical features seemed to be a little bit different, and there were too many of them for it just to be part of a spectrum. They stood outside that, and that was very evident when some, unfortunately, had a different antibody.
So what else are you particularly proud of? And we're talking about a Lifetime Achievement Award, so there's quite a lot there.
I actually was really one of the first to not to exactly identify genetic forms of myasthenia, because Andrew Engel had already described the first genetic form. It was I who told John Newsome Davis, who was the clinician who I was working with, the fact that there was a patient who didn't respond to plasma exchange but didn't have any antibodies. And if you don't have antibodies,
it must be genetic.
Exactly, because he didn't. I should have said it the other way around. So he didn't respond to plasma exchange, and he had no AChR antibodies. It all suggested that he had something different. And I said, because he then had onset very early in life, and he was now a man in his 30s, 40s, I think, and he came from a different country. So there wasn't very much background on that particular patient. But I said to John, I think we should study these patients because it might be really interesting. And we described, I was the first author, one of my first author papers, for five patients, and two of them seemed to have a rather similar syndrome, which turned out to be a fast channel syndrome many, many years later when the genes were identified. And the other three were slightly different from each other. But it was clear they all had a myasthenia, that they were almost certainly genetic, and there were, you know, heterogeneous collections. So I was probably the first person to show that there were lots of different genetic forms of myasthenia.
So that raises a point, and we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, several of the people that I've spoken to at this conference indicated to me that gene therapy would be relatively useless for myasthenia gravis because it's not a genetic disease, but rather an autoimmune disease. You're suggesting that may not be true.
No, they're completely distinct now. The ones who have a congenital myasthenic syndrome are the genetic ones, and they're now a whole population of them of their own. They're not so common. I mean, in the UK, I think we have about 200 cases.
That's it?
Yes, and of course, they've been accumulating over many years, so the incidence is pretty low, whereas the incidence of autoimmune myasthenia is, if anything, growing with these elderly people, late-onset myasthenia. They're growing, if anything, and it's really quite high, about 20 per million per year or even 30 per million per year, new cases. That's an incidence that's quite considerable.
In terms of your award, any final thoughts in the 60 seconds we have left?
Well, you know, I've been incredibly lucky. I was in the right place at the right time, and particularly I worked with the right people. And I had young children. I had four children, and they were very tolerant to the children, which was terribly important. You asked about the being a woman in a non-female environment. I barely noticed, because I suppose I wasn't that ambitious. I think if I'd been very pushy and ambitious, I wouldn't have got on so well. So there's something to being not very ambitious, and just learning on the job and doing what you feel is the right thing to do scientifically and in every other respect. Try to keep a happy group together.
Well, I liked how you ended your talk by saying that you hope that the science you've done has been helpful and impactful.
Well, people say it has, so perhaps I don't need to hope that any longer with this award.
We've been speaking with Dr. Angela Vincent of the University of Oxford in England. She's the recipient of the very first Lifetime Achievement Award given by the Myasthenia Gravis Foundation of America. This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor. Thank you.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.